Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life podcast. My guest on today's episode is Gino Ford. Gino is the head men's basketball coach at Stony Brook University in Long Island, New York. Before becoming the head coach at Stony Brook, he was an assistant there under Jeff Bowles and also has head coaching experience in Ohio at Shawnee State University, Kent State University, and Muskingum College. He played at Cambridge High School and was Ohio's Mr. Basketball in 1993, went on to an outstanding career at Ohio University, and in 2023 was inducted into the Ohio Basketball Hall of Fame. Please enjoy my conversation today about basketball and life with Gino Ford of Stony Brook University. Coach Ford, thanks for joining me today, man. I've never actually met you till right this minute, and you and I share a mutual acquaintance in Aaron Holler, who was kind of instrumental in setting this up, but I really appreciate your willingness.
No, I'm happy to be here. Now, the only thing that's concerning is I don't always admit that I know Aaron, and I certainly don't admit that I'm friends with him.
Secret's out now.
Secret's out. I certainly, Kim, his wife, is an absolute superstar, and somehow he managed to make that thing happen. So maybe he's deserving of more credit than I usually give him. But Aaron was a manager when I played at Ohio, and what a great guy. I had a lot of fun with Aaron. He was one of my close friends. I used to stay with him over winter break, and good guy, somebody that I like to bust his chops. So if anybody listens to this, feel free to tell him that I you know, he's a terrible dart player and can't shoot, and thank God his daughter's got Kim's athletic ability and looks and personality and just his name. That's all they got. That's why the girls are doing so well.
Well, when he was a manager at OU while I was a manager or student assistant at Ohio Northern, and he actually grew up not far from here. He went to Lima Bath High School, but we didn't know each other in high school. We met because he and J.J. Searles and Greg Orr, some OU guys, came to work camp at Northern, and that's how our paths crossed. And I for 30 years, we've stayed in touch and been close. But I can attest to the dart part. We played some darts back in the day after camp was over at night, and on certain days, he wasn't bad.
Yeah, I never saw those days. I only saw the days it wasn't very good. he's a piece of work. And Searles, I still talk to JJ on a consistent basis. And no, it's been good. I mean, those were great guys. Greg was just before, you know, me. He had graduated when I was coming in. I know him, but I never was around him a ton. But a great guy also. And a lot of good people that I've been fortunate to cross paths with. And I would hate for anyone to ever tell Aaron that I said that I enjoyed crossing paths with him. So,
well, maybe he won't listen to this.
Yeah, I have a feeling.
I think that's probably right. So you're an Athens area Cambridge guy, and I don't know how familiar you are with the podcast, but essentially what we do here is allow people to tell their story. Is one of the things that when I had the podcast going in 2020, and it went away for a while and for some specific reasons, but when I was getting ready to start it back up, Aaron was one of the first guys I talked to, and he said, you know, you need to get Gino on, because the premise of the podcast now, Coach, is basketball and life and the intersections of how our life's journey in this game, the game impacts our life, but a lot of times our life impacts how we see and perceive and participate in the game as well. And you've got what I would think is a fascinating journey. You grew up in a basketball family, and I just want to let you tell that story. So if you wouldn't mind, just tell us a little bit about growing up in your family, your high school career, and then ultimately your college career before we get into your coaching jaunt.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Cambridge, and my dad was the high school coach. And lucky for me, the elementary school that I went to was right across the street from the high school. So we got out at 3 o'clock, high school dismissed at 3:15. My dad had a prep period, last period of the day. So at 3 o'clock, I'd go right across the crosswalk, meet him in the main lobby. We'd go in, and he always swept the floor. And I don't, for the life of me, he enjoyed sweeping the floor. It was really, as I look back, it's one of my most vivid memories, is every single day I would get there at, you know, 5 after 3, and then I would beeline for the ball rack and just take off and be dribbling and probably shooting air balls from all over the place. And he was always sweeping the floor around that time. And then, you know, by the guys would get dressed after the bell, and I'd be at practice. I was there every day. And it was a great learning experience being on the side. I certainly learned not to dribble or shoot when he stopped practice and was talking. Got in trouble for that many a time. But I was, you know, I was lucky to grow up with that, and then played at Cambridge, and then went to Ohio. And to be honest, this is going to sound like I'm making it up, and to God, it's as true as truth could be. So my dad's team played, and I would have been in the neighborhood of third grade, fourth grade. Played in the district finals in the Convo against Lancaster, who had Bo Reed, whose dad was the coach, and Bo Reed went on to play at Nebraska. And I remember riding in the car, and we turned off of, you know, whatever state route that is that you get off the exit for the Convo, and it's before the football stadium got the add-on press box, and the trees weren't that tall. The view's not the same now, but you come around that turn, and all I see is the Convo. And, you know, I'm 10 years old, growing up in a small town. I've never seen anything look like that. I can remember sitting there looking at it and saying, man, I want to play here. And so we walk in and get our tickets for the game. And the way they used to have the Hall of Fame at Ohio, they had black and white pictures of everyone that was in the Hall of Fame, and then a short bio under them with just like bullet points, kind of what years they were there, and maybe, you know, an award or two that they might have won. What just so happened, right above the ticket office, there was a picture of Mike Schmidt. And I played baseball as a kid. I wasn't any good, which really irritated my dad, because he was a good baseball player. And I actually think my bad baseball bothered him more than my bad basketball. And I'm staring at this picture of Mike Schmidt. I remember just thinking, I'm going to come here and I'm going to get my picture up there. And I don't even know what I'm, you know, I don't know anything from anything. And several years later, I was lucky that they recruited me. Coach Hunter offered me a scholarship. I took it the second he offered it to me, which put him in a full panic, just like it does all coaches. We offer a lot. Then someone says yes immediately, and you go, uh-oh. Like, I don't know. So he let me he fought off his panic, let me go to school there, and really formed a lot of lifelong friendships. I mean, I'm on a text chain with 10 of my former teammates. Never, ever does a day go by where there's not stuff going. And most of it is the same bad jokes and making fun of guys for the same things we did back in the 90s. But, you know, I've just really, really was lucky that that was the path I had as a player, because a lot of great memories and, you know, a lot of great lifetime friends. That's for sure.
Well, I don't know what it says about me, but I had a similar reaction to the Convo as a full-fledged adult man when my daughter went to school at Ohio University. In her sophomore year, she lived in the Convo, and I'm thinking, man, this is damn cool. And she's like, Dad, I hate. She said, the only thing about OU that I hate is living in the Convo.
Yeah, I don't think those. Well, depending on when she was there, I don't know if they'd been renovated by then. I had been up there, and, you know, there's kind of two separate entrances, obviously, but the dorms over there were not the best on campus. She had a fair complaint. I never lived there. The athletes, we lived over in Boyd Hall, which is, you know, not far from there. It's still on the West Green or whatever, but yeah, that's pretty funny that she was in there. I wouldn't have enjoyed living in there because I was in there all the time shooting. I needed to get away.
Well, that happened for her. The bad part was the dorms weren't in terrible shape, but that happened to be the 1920 school year. So she got sent home early anyway when COVID set in. So the experience probably wasn't great, but she would live in Athens today if we'd let her, and she could, and have a career. She's just graduated a little over a year ago and loves it and loves the place. And everything I hear about it, people don't talk about OU to me that don't sound like you sound, that it was home for them. And it certainly was for my daughter. But your time there as a player, I mean, it's really interesting to me we talk all the time to people about, and especially young players, hey, college is a different level. High school is one level. College is a different level. But it's not all that common. It's maybe somewhat common, but it's not super common, you know, to have somebody have the type of success that you had as a high school player and a college player, very similar in terms of production and output and the impact that you had as a high school player in Ohio and on the basketball program at Ohio University. Obviously, you had to put a lot of work into that. You played with good teammates. But can you talk a little bit about your college playing days? And did you know when you went to OU that you would maybe think about coaching one day, or is that something that developed later?
No, I mean, the coaching thing, I honestly, it was maybe in the back of my mind that I might do it, but I didn't grow up desiring to be a coach. I wanted to be a player. I was delusional. I wanted to play in the NBA. I mean, that was all I thought about. So, as a college player, when I got to Ohio, the rules are different now. Back then, nobody went to summer school unless you screwed up and needed it for eligibility. And you weren't allowed to do workouts with the team, so you could go lift. And as an upperclassman, I lived off campus, and so I had year-round housing. And I was in the weight room with our strength coach full-time. But it was illegal for any of the coaches to rebound or pass or work me out in the summer. So anytime I was in the gym, I was on my own. But when I got there, and I'm sure that Aaron will remember this, it was an interesting situation because they had, we had Gary Trent, who was the player of the year returning as a post player. We had Jason Terry as a post player, 7'2", from Mount Gilead, who had the conference record for block shots for years. It's been broken since, but I mean, he was a good college player. And so the front court was excellent. Now we also had a couple guys, Ryan Greenwood and Kevin Murphy, that thought they were good that never got in as front court guys. And boy, I hope they hear that. And then of course, you know, Jeff Bowles, who's the current coach, was on the team, and he was a heck of a player. So, you know, if one of those two guys needed a sub, it was going to be Bowles. It certainly wasn't going to be Greenwood or Murphy. But there were also guards back that had played my senior year of high school. So Gus Johnson had started every game as a freshman, and blew his knee out at the end of the season. So he was kind of on a rehab thing. And you know, when I was doing recruiting visits, I went to Ohio State my junior year on an unofficial, and I'll be honest, I grew up not liking Ohio State. I never liked Ohio State. I had no interest in ever playing at Ohio State. I don't root for Ohio State football. I know that sounds crazy being from there, but I'm not a football, Ohio State football guy. I love to go at it with Holler and many others that are. But all that said, the other visit I took was Cincinnati. And so when I got to Cincinnati, it was Nick Van Exel was the point guard. And anybody that ever saw Nick Van Exel play, even if they didn't see me play, would know how much better he is than I was ever going to be. So I was like, what am I doing here? They weren't begging me to go to Cincinnati by any stretch, but I was there on a visit and I was like, this got no shot. And then I took a visit to OU and I'm watching guys like Gus and Chad Estes and Mike Reese and Rush Floyd, who I had played in a game with. And I'm like, okay, listen, this makes more sense. I think I can play here. You know, I think I can play here. And so I go there, and the first month of school, we had open gyms. I don't think I scored in the month of September. A little of it was I had never lifted, and they put us on a 3-day-a-week lifting routine. I mean, I couldn't lift my arms above my shoulders. I was done. I was done. I weighed 155 pounds, and I played awful in September and really didn't know if I was going to redshirt, thought about transferring to Muskingum most of the month because I'm like, I don't think I could ever play here. Like, I'm just getting the crap kicked out of me every day. And then a little of it was I had come in with a little bit of media stuff. I mean, nothing major, but those guys wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to come in and be real good. So, like, Bowles is illegal screening me every freaking trip down the court, and I got guys, you know, fouling me for fun and all that. It was fine, but you know, they wanted to try to send a message that I wasn't going to have an easy time there. And I played horrible, and I honestly didn't think I'd ever play. And this is true. I tell it to him to bust his chops, but it's a true story. So we start practice October 15th. The night before practice started, I was in the gym. Jason Terry was in the gym with me. We were just shooting. And Chad Estes, who was our senior captain and was going to be the starting two guard, and I decided to play one-on-one. And we were going to play a best of five to whatever we were going to play to. And I swept him. And it wasn't even close. And it was literally that night when I went back to the dorm, I remember thinking, like, oh, man, I'm better than these guys. Like, I don't know that I wasn't better than them, but I felt like I certainly could be successful. And it changed my whole confidence level. And we went into practice, and I ended up being lucky enough to start as a freshman on the NCAA tournament team and able to score, you know, 9 a game or 10 a game or whatever, and we certainly didn't fast break or play fast. So I had a pretty good year, all things considered. But it, you know, I don't know if I don't play Chad Estes and beat him that night before practice starts, maybe I would have had a different turning point mentally. But that's the one moment I would point to that where I felt like, okay, I'm at the right place. I can play here, and let's stop thinking about transferring and stop about redshirting every hour of every day.
Well, that story by itself puts a smile on my face, because I talked about meeting Aaron through the camp at Ohio Northern, and you mentioned Gus and Chad both worked our camp at Ohio Northern when they were playing at OU. And the only thing I can tell you that I remember about Chad Estes is that guy had a work ethic. Man, every meal break, every time we had downtime, he wasn't just in the gym getting shots up. He was in the gym punishing himself to a degree, and so those are good guys to come up under. I would imagine that was certainly helpful. But let's fast forward a little bit. You play your career out there, and like I said, have a remarkable career. At what point during your junior senior season, when did you start maybe leaning toward the idea that you might pursue college coaching? I know the GA thing was kind of your first stop. When did that become something that you were cognizant of and thinking about?
Yeah, so what happened was my senior year finished, and the all-conference team my senior year was Bonzi Wells, who was a lottery pick, Wally Zerbiak, who was a lottery pick, Antonio Daniels, who was a lottery pick, and then me, and I, you know, our team we lost the championship on the last day of the season. So we were, you know, like in college, I mean, we were 4-4 against Bowling Green. We never won in Anderson Arena, and Antonio Daniels never won in the combo. And I know that Antonio Daniels is way better than me, but I got invited to the NBA pre-draft camp at Portsmouth, Virginia. And I went down there and didn't play well. But it was that time where I was like, okay, there's no shot. And the reason is I was a two guard. I was never a point guard. I played point guard as a freshman in college and most of my sophomore year, but most of the success I had, I was moved off the ball and played, you know, more on the wing. So I get to the NBA combine stuff, and obviously I'm the shortest guy by a mile, and I'm playing point guard, and I got Travieso, the guy from UMass, picking me up. In Padilla, Edgar Padilla, like picking me up full court. And I'm telling you, like, I'm just like, okay, just don't turn it over. Like, I wasn't going to go buy him and go get a layup. It was just, let's not turn it over. Let's get it to somebody else before something bad happens with me having the ball. And And so after that, I was like, all right, the NBA thing's definitely not happening. I didn't get invited to Chicago, which I knew I wouldn't based on how I played. But they only in those days invited 64 seniors. And this is before there was no underclassmen coming out. There might be one high school guy, but it was college seniors getting drafted. And so they'd have 64 guys at Portsmouth, and like 30 of them would get to go on to the Chicago thing. And then, you know, several of them got drafted. And I mean, the year before, I don't remember my year, but Derek Fisher was the MVP the year before. So like there, you know, there were like pros coming out of Portsmouth. It was just evident I wasn't going to be one. So I got a chance to go to Europe, and I had like five different chances of places I could go. I was married, I had a son, and I was not going to go live in Europe, like in a country that I thought would be hard to navigate because my wife was going to be going with me. So we decided to go to England. And I went to Leicester, England, had a great experience, had a really fun year, played, coached the youth team, did some clinics. And then the year ended. And they fired our coach, and the owner offered me a contract, a 2-year contract as player coach, which I told him I needed 30 days to just make a decision. I said, I'm probably going to do it, but give me a month. So I came back to the States, and my wife had come home before me with our son. Like she had left before the end of the season, and I came back. And I needed to work out. I didn't have really, I mean, I had a gym at Cambridge, but there weren't a lot of people for me to play against in Cambridge at that time that were going to, you know, necessarily help me get better. So my brother was on the team at Ohio as a sophomore. So I went down and told him I was going to stay with him for a couple days and play open gym at OU. Well, the first day I'm there, we have open gym. Coach Hunter asked if I wanted to go to lunch. So I said, sure. So I went to lunch with Coach Hunter, and he said, listen, he said, I got a GA position open. Why don't you start your coaching career? And, you know, at the end of the year, I'll make sure you get something, full-time job. So that's how it started. I went back and talked to my wife, and I'm like, look, I mean, I got it. At that time, I should also explain, everybody had three assistants except Ohio only had two. So even though my title was GA, I was going to have to be responsible for some of the perimeter guys. I was going to be responsible for scouting reports. You know, I was going to be coaching because we only had two full-time positions instead of three. And so it was a great experience. And I decided after thinking about it, that what am I going to do? You know, like I can keep going around Europe, but I'm not making enough money that I'm going to retire early. And when I get done playing, I'm going to have to do something and certainly get the chance to coach at Ohio with Coach Hunter, who I had, you know, just so much respect for, was something that I wasn't going to turn down. So if he doesn't take me to lunch and they don't have a GA leave, I would have just gone back to Europe for another year or two at least, because I enjoyed it over there. I had no problem being there playing, but the timing of it just worked out how it did. And then at the end of the season, I promoted to full-time assistant. And then all of a sudden I was, you know, 24 years old as a Division I assistant coach, you know, and kind of got my career moving from there.
Well, I am very fond on this podcast of saying that anybody who's invested much of their life in this game and pursued it with a passion has a unique story, but I'm not entirely sure that you might not be one of one in the category of my first coaching decision was a choice between a GA spot and a player coach in Europe. I don't think a lot of guys were staring down those options.
I could tell you this. It would have been a very, very thin playbook. Hey, play one, I dribble down and shoot. Play two, I throw to you. You throw back to me and I shoot. It would have been, I don't know that I would have had four guys that wanted to play with me. So, but I'd had a heck of a strategy.
We got about 6 minutes here before we need to take a break. And in that 6 minutes, talk a little bit about the value of being a graduate assistant. You just mentioned that you were maybe not the typical GA because you were going to coach, but in terms of shaping shaping your desire and your vision of maybe becoming a head coach one day? What was the value of being a GA, and what specific lessons can you recall from that 1 year?
Well, I think a lot of what you learn is the off-the-floor stuff. Because, listen, a lot of people can draw plays. A lot of people can, you know, work with a guard and make them better. And I think, you know, you look now to how many trainers have cropped up and, you know, they do all the drills and try to help people be more skilled. But the real coaching is dealing with media, dealing with boosters, dealing with players' expectations, dealing with outside sources' expectations of those players, scheduling, getting guys to study hall, and making sure that the degrees are being, completed. There's just so many pieces to coaching that, I mean, honestly, on the floor is one of the smaller parts of your job, especially when you have those positions. Like when you're a GA, I mean, my gosh, your whole day is full, and it's everything from managing study hall to scheduling games to booking hotels to getting flights for trips. Very little of your time is actually, hey, let's go get some shots and try to make you a better player. That's not much of your day. It's a couple hours of it. And the amount of workload, and Coach Hunter was, oh my gosh, what a relentless worker. I mean, first off, you couldn't beat the guy in the office. You had no chance. It didn't matter what time you got there. He was already there, camped out. And as far as going home at night, you know, Coach was married, but he was basically married to the game. And I mean, 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night, he'd still be in there. He had no social calendar, no outside interests. Thank God he became a little bit of a golfer, and that got us out of the office a little bit. But I mean, if he didn't play golf, we could have had our birthdays in there and not realized it. I mean, it was long days.
Well, I like hearing you talk about the off the floor things, because I really feel like anybody that even sparks a minor interest in coaching, it's the X's and O's, and it's the teaching of the game, and it's that on court stuff that we all get super passionate about. And I'm going to go ahead and say that I think one of the things that can drive guys and ladies away from coaching maybe earlier than they would have expected is they don't quite grasp how important that other stuff is, and having a plan for it and being able to manage it. Because it is such an important thing. And so, you know, as a student assistant, those were the things we did, and that's what I was cognizant of. But your spot as a GA, you get a taste of those things, and then obviously the grind of it. I mean, it's not a big secret, I don't think, that a lot of great players have a hard time becoming really good coaches, because embracing that grind isn't easy. But for you, it seems that grind became a part of it that you really loved. And in a couple of minutes that we've got left, I just talk briefly, if you would, here. I'll let you know if we've got to stop. But when did you start thinking head coach maybe is in my future?
Well, before I do that, I don't know that I ever loved all of the grind. Let's clarify that, because, I mean, when you're coaching at Ohio, and it's different now, they've invested in winning. And that's great to see. And you know, Jeff, who's down there now, is just a tremendous coach, and he's going to win really big. But when I was there, there were no charter flights like they have now. So we would bus back from Central Michigan and get in at 6 a.m. And as a player, you're going to go home and blatantly skip class, even though you're told you're threatened not to. And you're going to show up for practice at 3 p.m. and practice is going to be light. As an assistant, you get in at 6, you go grab a shower, and you're back in the office by 7:30. So it was a different experience than as a player. And as a player, my junior and senior year, I'm averaging almost 20 a game on good teams. I was treated like I mattered. As a GA, I was treated like, hey, man, there's some trash in the corner. You need to get that. And why didn't you already get it? The grind was fine. But, I didn't mean to get off topic and not answer. But, you know, as far as head coach, I mean, once you get in coaching, you always want to be a head coach. I think that everybody gets that itch, but a lot of us don't get lucky. And it's all timing. Jobs are timing. jobs are timing. I know we got a break coming up, but I'll tell you, you know, a funny story about applying for head coaching jobs.
I'll tell you what, why don't you go ahead and hold the story? We'll take our break now. We'll kick off the second half with that.
Perfect.
Awesome. Great. We'll go ahead and take our break and be right back. I just want to take a quick second and interrupt the podcast for a minute to remind you that our new platform for the podcast is Spotify for Podcasters. And if you're listening on Spotify, you have an opportunity to make a donation to the podcast if you would be inclined to do so. Thanks for considering any sort of donation. One time, monthly, or other regular donations are certainly welcome. Spotify for Podcasters is our platform, and they're providing an easy option for you to do so just by clicking the link at the end of the episode. Thanks for your consideration. And now back to the podcast. All right, sorry to interrupt our conversation, but the break was necessary. So go ahead. You wanted to tell a story about the head coaching search and pursuit.
Yeah, so the first job I got, Coach Hunter, you know, we had won 20 and 19 games back-to-back years when I was his assistant. That's before exempt term. And so we're like, you know, 20 and 10. We weren't 20 and 18 or anything like that. And at the end of the year, he got in contract dispute with the AD, and the AD decided to fire him with a year left on his contract, coming off of 20 wins, which got a lot of negative national attention, obviously, and was a ridiculous decision. But, you know, the argument must have gotten to the point where that's what they decided to do. And I within 24 hours, Jim Arnzen, whose dad Bob is a legend in Ohio, you know, as a coach, Jim was the AD and head coach at Shawnee State, and he called me the next morning and said, listen, would you like to be the head coach at Shawnee State? And I knew Shawnee State because Shawnee State was in the same conference as Ohio Dominican, where my uncle Ed DeGenova had been a head coach at Ohio Dominican and played Shawnee State. And he had always told me what a good guy Jim Arnzen was. So I'm like, yeah, this would be great. I have no job, and maybe I got a job. So it's a state school. So it took them a month or so to post it and go through. And I got the job, and I coached there. But the funny story I was going to tell is, so I left Shawnee State after a year. I got a chance to go to Kent State and work for Jim Christian. And Kent State had just gone to the Elite Eight, and they were returning quite a bit of the team. So it was one of those things, and it was like, geez, I mean, I was going to make double the money, and I loved my time at Shawnee State. And I would tell you, Shawnee State is an absolute terrific institution, and athletically it has a lot of things going for it. I mean, as evidenced by they won the national championship a few years ago in basketball, and they'd already done it in the women's side. So I really, really liked Shawnee State. But going to Kent as an assistant was something I felt I had to do career-wise. It just was, you know, too good of a situation. So I'm at Kent. We win the league. We win 20 games all 3 years. At the end of the third year, the Youngstown State job comes open. And if you know the history of Youngstown State, it's not a program that's had a lot of success, right, over their history. And Kent is 30 miles down the road from Youngstown. So I'm thinking, well, if there's any job I can get, it's this one. I mean, these guys, they don't win. It's right down the street. We're winning. This makes a lot of sense. So I apply for the job, and I don't even get an interview. Now, 2 years later, I'm at Kent. We go to the NCAA tournament. We're a 9 seed. My boss, Jimmy Christian, gets the TCU job. I get promoted to the head coach at Kent State. So I'm a head coach at a place that had been ranked in the top 25 the year we were a 9 seed. And I wouldn't have gone to Youngstown State if you drugged me there. But 2 years earlier, I was disappointed that I couldn't get even this. It's just all timing. I mean, you know, like it's all timing. And then, you know, when I was at Kent, I was there 3 years. We had had a ton of, we lost all of our you know, main guys, certainly in the front court. And we won like 19 games my first year, which was honestly, by what had been done there, was not a great year. Our schedule was brutal, but we didn't win 20, which was the first time in a while that had happened. And then the next 2 years, we won the league back to back. And when we did it, it was the first time in 50 years that anyone had ever won the Mid-American Conference 2 years in a row as a outright champ. So, you know, we had a lot of success there in the short time, but it was just funny because, you know, I always think back to, man, oh man, I was begging for that job. And now all of a sudden I got a job that's 10 to 15 times better than the job I thought I had to have 2 years earlier. So coaching is timing, man. You know, it's just timing. You get a little lucky, or, and sometimes you get lucky by not getting something.
I don't suppose that there's any way to really have tracked it. Maybe you aren't driven maniacally by rejection the way some people are, but I would wonder almost, though, is by the time you're winning your second MAC title in a row, if somebody at Youngstown State saying, who's the dumbass that wouldn't interview this guy?
I don't think there was. And I think there, like every job you ever have, probably, even though we won the two championships in a row, probably half the season ticket holders in Kent would have driven me to Youngstown and dropped me off. So it's, you know, it never seems to matter in coaching unless you're winning at the absolute premium level every single year. I mean, you know, you got a guy like Mike Krzyzewski is going to be certainly beloved, rightfully so, Rick Pitino. You get below that tier of superstars, and there's a lot of us that, you know, grind it out. And you know, sometimes the fans are excited about you, and sometimes and oftentimes they're not.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and you brought up the Shawnee State one-year experience before you had an opportunity to become a Division I assistant. I mean, that's a no-brainer decision. But I've got a buddy in the basketball world who used to say to me that he believed that every head coach ought to become an assistant at some point during their career before they become a head coach again. He thinks there's real value in being an assistant after having been a head coach. Did you feel like you gained anything from your 1 year as a head coach when you became an assistant again? Did it help you? Was it impactful in any way?
Yeah, and I remember, to your point, when I came to Stony Brook as Jeff's assistant, it was his first head coaching job. And I remember telling him, I said, you know, in about a week into the season, you're going to call Thad Mata and apologize for how little you actually cared. You thought you cared at Ohio State, and you worked your butt off, and you thought you really cared. And now that you're the head coach, you're going to see how little you really did care, because this is a whole different animal. You know, here's how I would describe it, right? As an assistant, you're dying for the team to be successful. You're working really hard to try to do your part to help the team be successful. And then practice ends, and you go home. And maybe you have to make a phone call or two with recruiting, but generally you can get in the shower and then have dinner with your family and kind of pivot into having a life. Head coach, your brain never turns off. You're always, you just can't stop. I mean, it's concern about, because you're managing so many people, from whether it be, you got five assistant coaches that report to you, you got a strength coach you got to work with, you got an athletic trainer you got to work with, you got boosters you got to make sure, help, you know, informed of what's going on and excited about continuing to be a booster, because without financial support, it's impossible to win. Nobody wins by themselves. You got to have people that are propping you up. You got academic, you know, wing of folks. Then you're always worried about a guy, you know, make sure they're making good decisions away from basketball, because you know, it's obvious. I mean, it's not a negative thing about the media. It's just how it is. I mean, one bad thing happens, that's the whole media line. That's going to steal the day, and it's going to reflect on all 15 people in the locker room, not just the player who made the bad decision. So you have all these kind of things going, and you got to work with administrators. So there's really always something to be doing, or always something to be preparing for. The recruiting, you've got to be the closer usually. I mean, once in a while, assistants can just get guys to come to a school. Usually head coaches have to participate in that. And you just have a lot, you're getting pulled in a lot of directions. And as an assistant, your job can be a little more, you know, you work hard, you grind, you get beat, you're mad. But at some point, you can turn it off a little bit and have a life. And as a head coach, you can never turn it off. It's just not possible.
I started saying about 5 years ago to some people when we had this conversation that I felt like the number one objective of an assistant coach was to make the head coach's life as easy as possible without making your own life unbearable.
And, yeah, I think you're right.
And I think there's real value in it, but what I guess we all come to discover if we're around it very long is no matter what the assistants do to make the head coach's life easier, you're right. That the head coach can't turn it off. You're just not permitted to do so.
No, there's always something going. I mean, and you know, when I was whether it was Jimmy Christian or I'll tell you this, when I was with Coach Hunter, I mean, I was young and had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I was working, but probably not very smart. And spinning my wheels in a lot of ways. But your biggest job, I feel like when I was with Jeff, my biggest goal was to keep stuff off his desk. Like mm-hmm. I was always I'd go to the academic person. Hey, what's going on? Come to me with the problem. If I can fix it, I'm going to fix it. So he doesn't have to deal with it. You know, you go to the just every kind of angle with people and that touch the players and make sure that things are going well and try to troubleshoot before it has to get to his desk, because there's plenty of stuff on his desk that are making his life hard enough. So, you know, you can never stop everything, but you know, anything you can kind of stop is usually a good thing.
We could probably do an entire podcast, you know, on Jim Christian. And I think the guy's a terrific coach. And I think in the coaching world, particularly in Division I basketball, it's real easy to be undervalued because of what TV does to those top tier guys. And it's really difficult for a lot of people to conceptualize of what a good job Jim Christian did at Kent and other places as well. But when you get promoted and you become the head coach to a program that has high expectations, has had a level of success, the cliche thing that we always hear is coaches have to make the program their own. Can you talk about the program that you inherited and what were your priorities? I mean, outside of we just got to keep winning games, what were your priorities in trying to make that program yours?
Well, you know, great question. I'll be honest, and a lot of this I would say has to do with having played. I try really hard to, although ultimately in college basketball, a lot of emphasis put on the head coach, I want it to be the players' program. I'm not the guy, you'll never find me on a team picture sitting in the middle holding the ball and up. The coaches that decide to do that, that's not me. I try to manage the program, and at Kent was tricky because Jim was the winningest coach in the history of the Mid-American Conference. Jim offensively is elite. I'm telling you, I sat on the bench with a guy for 4 years as an assistant. He would call a play. Every play had a counter. He would call a play. The other team, maybe they went over a flare screen, and he knew that the counter, if we slipped it early, would work. And he would just register it. And two trips later down the floor, he'd call a counter to what we'd already shown him recently, and we'd get ourselves an easy basket. He got, for the 7 years he was at Kent, I would guarantee you on average, he got 2 to 3 easy baskets for our team every single game. And I'm telling you, that's impossible to do, really. I mean, it's such an incredible feat. I mean, he calls plays with other plays in mind down the road. He just sees offense. He really does. He sees offense. A lot of times, defensively, I used to joke with him. He thought that's just what we had to do to pass our time until we could get the ball back. But he offensively was unbelievable. I mean, he was so good. It was scary. Other coaches in the league, they knew how good he was. Our efficiency numbers were always great. And Jimmy, he's just a heck of a basketball coach. I mean, I was lucky to be around him, and I wish more of it rubbed off on the offense. I mean, because I'm telling you, you know, he's got it. I don't know. There's not a ton of guys that see offense as well as he does.
I think, you know, as you're talking about that, what's registering with me is as the game evolves, that becomes continually more and more important. I mean, I'm not saying that defense isn't important. I'm a defense first guy, and I was raised in programs that were that, and it's never going to not have value. But boy, the way the game has evolved, the ability to see the game offensively and be a little bit ahead is an incredibly valuable skill.
Yeah, I think, you know, kids, growing up, right, the influx of these trainers, and some of them are, it's like any profession, some of them are awesome and some of them are not very good for the players mentally or basketball wise, but everybody, all they do is work on dribble, shoot, pass. Nobody posts up anymore. You don't find traditional centers very often. The kids are way more skilled. Like the ball handling in today's game is way better than the ball handling was in the 90s when I played. You know, just guys were able to do more stuff. I mean, I got guys that'll, you know, between the legs, behind the back, crossover, and be gone. And it's like, you know, that wasn't how the game was played. You didn't over dribble, you passed, you screened, you cut. So the game's changed, and you got to change with it, and I don't disagree. I mean, I grew up in around defense at Muskingum as a kid. I at Ohio, we spent – I mean, this is a fact. I played on a top 25 team at Ohio. This is our entire playbook. Fan it high pick, which we hardly ever ran. Fan it high pushdown, which we ran once a month. And then we had a couple motion starters, motions 2, 3, and 4 – and motion 2 was nothing more than a single double. And then we did high low. And fan it high was high low. And fan it was a weak side pin down. I mean, we literally had a playbook that was like 5 things we were going to do in a game. And that's it. Now, the thing is, when you do it like that, you're going to be really good at those 5 things. But if people can take them away, offense gets a little tough, and that's why those games were grinded out, you know, in the 50s and low 60s a lot of times.
Yeah.
But today, like, you don't find a lot of teams that can successfully just defend their way to a lot of success. Once in a while you do. Like, I thought San Diego State last year, they definitely have some guys that are very gifted individually, offensively, but they got to the Final Four with, you know, with defense. If you really go watch, it was, they were so great on defense, and they were pretty good on offense. And I think Houston was so great on defense and pretty good on offense. But if you're not at least pretty good on offense, you got no chance. I mean, you just can't defend yourself to enough wins in today's game with the shorter shot clock and the pace and everything. It's just not really that doable.
I think Coach Burson and Coach Doherty would like to have a conversation with you and I for even stating what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, two guys that initially are credited with banning fast breaks. You know, we just off the air. I thought when I was at a Muskingum game one year, the point guard stole the ball at half court, and I heard Coach Burson screaming, hold up, like he was about the 1-on-0 fast break. They did not believe in that at all. You're talking about guys that won hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of games and did it with defense and toughness and, you know, great coaches, great programs. I grew up on Division III basketball in Ohio. I saw more Ohio Athletic Conference games before the age of 18 than about anybody in America, because I also went to Muskingum road games. And then I was – you know, they played every Wednesday, Saturday. I was at all the holiday tournaments.
Yep.
I watched my dad's team play Tuesday, Friday, and Wednesday, Saturday was Muskingum, and I was there. I mean, I went to Ohio Northern to see a Muskingum game. I've been to Capitol. I mean, that's not a trip. Ohio Northern's hard to get to from New Concord, Ada. That's not easy. Yes, Ada can't get there from anywhere, really, but what a great place that is. Beautiful campus.
Well, amen to that. It is not easy to get from New Concord to Ada or in reverse. It's not an easy trip. But we didn't touch on it yet. You had a brief stint as a head coach at Muskingum in Division III basketball. Can you spend 5 or so minutes talking about your experience there, what precipitated that, and what that experience was like for you?
Yeah, you know, honestly, when I took the job, I thought I'd stay there forever. And I love Muskingum. I mean, I have such great memories as a kid, and I really enjoyed the 2 years I was there. There were a couple things that led to me leaving. One was, to be honest, a little bit of a frustration with, I think there's a great perception in the world that Division III basketball is very pure and it's the most, you know, even field because nobody's getting scholarships. And I'm going to tell you that before the NIL and all of the insanity of guys making $400,000 to play college basketball started, you know, within the last 18 months. If you go prior to 18 months ago, I'm going to tell you that the most unlevel playing field is Division III. I mean, you're not allowed to repackage guys. We were recruiting guys that we would have a financial aid offer for. It would beat someone in the league. Or more often, a couple of the NCAC powerhouse schools. And all of a sudden, the kid would get a new package. But it wasn't, quote, repackaging because, you know, the other one was an estimate, was the official ruling. But the reality was they would find a leadership grant of some sort to give a kid that would make it cheaper. And so it was a little frustrating, to be honest. I mean, you know, you're at Muskingum, you know, you need a point guard, and you can't just go know that you're going to get one, even if all the packaging looks great. So that was hard. And we had a really, really good year. My first year there, inherited a great situation. Coach Burson left it in a great place, and we were able to bring in a recruit guard and a freshman guard, Trevor Scott, and Brandon Todd transferred in, and all of a sudden, with what was already there, we had a really nice team, and I'm pretty sure it's still the best record they've had in the last 40 years was that year, but I might be all wrong on that, but I think it is, and it was, you know, we had good players. Cole Pittis was returning. Cole Pittis, one of my favorite players I've ever coached. I've said this all along. He's one of the 5 best centers I've ever had. And the guy played at Muskingum. He was just 6'4". He could have played for me at Bradley. He could have played for me at Kent. Could have played for me here. We would have never recruited him because he was 6'4". But what a great player, great leader, and touch and feel and footwork and all that stuff. So I really, really liked it. It was frustrating with the recruiting, but at the end of the year, second year, what had happened was, and we had a good team returning, Jimmy Christian had an assistant leave Kent, and Lang Kennedy, the AD, told me that, you know, he wouldn't make any promises, but he'd always like to hire within. And Jimmy had just won 20 games for a 6th time. And I liked Jimmy. I didn't leave on bad terms. I was still around the program when I was gone. Matter of fact, we took Muskingum up and played Kent. It was a hard decision, but I knew Jimmy was going to be leaving Kent. And it just so happened that I went back to Kent in August. And in March, I was the head coach because Jimmy got the TCU job. So from a career standpoint, it worked out. If it hadn't been going back to Kent, if Jimmy would have taken a job the year before and they had a new head coach, I'd still probably be at Muskingum. I mean, I really, really love that place. And just great people. I mean, it's funny how I've become old, but you know, it's Mayberry at Muskingum. I mean, it's the Andy Griffith Show, man. It's everybody, small town America, nice people, take care of you, help you. It's a great work-life balance coaching Division III. You know, you can have a life as a Division III coach. Not something's easy to do, Division I or II, but, I mean, you know, the Division III stuff, the schools that win It's because the president wants to win, and it's because the financial aid director wants to win, and the admission counselor wants to win. If those three people want to win, you can win anywhere. And I mean, you look around, there's a few good examples, and I'm not going to get into it because I'm not trying to take shots at anybody. God bless you. I wish Muskingum would do this because of how much I like the place. But the bottom line is, if those three people are in alignment, there's a couple programs in Ohio that historically were horrible and all of a sudden started winning. And it's because they got administrations that said, hey, we want to win in basketball, or we want to win in football, and let's figure it the heck out. And you figure it out with admissions and financial aid at Division III. It's not a, hey, we got a beautiful facility. So Division III is tricky, man. Those guys that coach Division III, you're either in a place that wants to win and you got a chance, or there's a lot of them that, you know, they don't have a commitment from the administration, and then it really gets almost impossible to win. And, you know, but it can change, and it has drastically changed at a couple in-state schools. And I'm sure you know who we're talking about. God bless. Good for them. It's not a negative. It's a positive. I mean, I'm for coaches, and I'm for people winning and for people investing in basketball. It's not a negative, but it's just a fact of Division III life, man. There's some spots you really can't win without the help of financial aid and admissions.
You know, I'm laughing because I love the way you're presenting it. I think we would have a very small but feverish audience if we just decided to do podcasts about the challenges of Division III financial aid and the repackaging concept. I think we could get people to listen.
And what's great is all the schools will deny it, but the coaches, if you can get them to go without revealing their identity, they would all admit to it, and they all know that it goes on. And God bless the guys that are able to do it and that are winning. But Division III, man, it's hard. It's really hard. I mean, it's the administrations win in Division III more than the teams. I mean, I hate to say that, but that's really true.
I don't think that can be denied, Coach. I really don't. Let's use the time that we've got left to talk about your making the move to Bradley, and maybe some lessons that you learned, things that you gained from your time at Bradley, and then I really want to dive into your decision to join Coach Bowles at Stony Brook and how that's played out in your becoming the leader of that program.
Yeah, so Bradley, you know, we won the league 2 out of 3 years at Kent, and I had a chance to go to Bradley. I had a situation change at Kent. I had a great experience at Kent. I was there for 7 years total. Lang Kennedy, the athletic director at Kent State, one of the finest human beings and best leaders I've ever been around. And, you know, he had retired. There were some changes of how things were being done. And I had an opportunity to go to Bradley, who was in the Missouri Valley. It was a league that got 4 teams in the NCAA tournament. Bradley had finished dead last and was losing the leading returning scorer. So I knew it was a, you know, total rebuild. And quite frankly, it's the one and only time in my life where I got somewhere and just got my butt kicked and had very, very little success. And that was hard because, you know, as a player, I certainly would not argue that I was a great player. I was not. But I had success as a player. I had success as a coach everywhere I'd been, some level of success, and got to Bradley. And I mean, my second year, we had a winning record, but 3 of the 4 years, we were not very good. And it was a hard job at the time because, you know, Wichita State was ranked number 1 in the country. Creighton had Doug McDermott, the National Player of the Year. Southern Illinois had been to the Sweet 16 like 5 or 6 years in a row. Northern Iowa went to the Sweet 16 a couple of the 4 years that I was at Bradley. There were so many good teams in there that, you know, you're playing an 18-game schedule. Well, Wichita State, you're 0-2. Creighton, you're 0-4. Northern Iowa, you're 0-6. Let's see how you do in your other 12 league games. And we were 7-5 that are up in those 12. But 7-5 against normal teams, you got to add in the top 25 teams that are in your league that are beating your brains in, and you finish 7-11. I wouldn't say it was, it's funny, I wouldn't really use the term it was humbling, because I've never really felt I don't feel arrogant as a coach. Like, I've never thought I was some great coach. I've never thought I was some genius who knew, you know, knew all the answers. I've never, ever, ever felt that way. So I wouldn't say it was humbling. I would almost use the term, it was a little startling, because it was the first time in my life that I literally just was embarrassed at how things were going and couldn't turn it around. We're trying like crazy, but we just kept failing at every turn. So it was hard professionally, personally, especially the last 2 years, because, you know, we got to the winning record year two. You felt like you had something going. And then we just took a step backwards, and then it just kind of fell apart on us in the last year. So we had a lot of injuries the last year. I mean, a ton. But that all said, we wouldn't have been that good anyway. I don't think we'd have had a winning record. We could have probably got ourselves to 13 or 14 wins, which would have been better than, I think, the 9 we had. But Bradley's got a passionate fan base. I like the people there a lot. The first time I'd been somewhere where the community was so invested in winning and losing. You know, Kent has a good following. Bradley's a community of 300,000 people, and there's nothing else around it. There's no pro sports. You're 2.5 hours from Chicago. You're 3 hours from St. Louis. Bradley dominates a 300,000 person community, and there's no football team, so it's just basketball. And so you couldn't go out to eat and not see. I mean, it's boosters and fans everywhere. It's a college town.
Right.
So it was great, except we weren't any good. And that was, you know, it was embarrassing. I mean, it was hard. It was hard, like I said. And so then I took a year off because I was still under contract. And you know, I still had time in my contract, so I was still being paid. So I moved to Florida, and I did television for ESPN. I you know, just did games kind of as a you know, an at-will employee on when they wanted me. And I probably did a dozen or so games for ESPN. And I enjoyed that because I got to go to people's practices and people's shoot-arounds and saw a lot of different teams and how they did things. And at the end of the year, Jeff got the Stony Brook job. And my youngest son's name is David Jeffrey, after Jeff. I was in Jeff's wedding. Jeff's one of the people I've always looked up to. And you know, he was a captain when I was a freshman. So how are you not going to, you know, like JJ's point, you're always a manager. Well, he's always been a captain in my eyes. You know, yeah, so I was always viewed him. And so, I came to Stony Brook. I'd never set foot on Long Island in my life. It is a beautiful place. There's so many things to do. You can be in New York City within an hour. But I can be at the beach if I want in 5 minutes. I you know, there's just so many things to do out here, and it's a really beautiful place. And you know, I'll go into half a dozen Yankee games. I'll go into a few Knicks games. I'll go to some Nets games. I mean, it's a lot of entertainment in New York, and Stony Brook is an elite academic school. And I would say that Jeff, his biggest impact on my career was this. We have zero problem guys. I mean, like, knock on wood, anything could ever happen. But, I mean, we have a 3.3 team GPA. Our guys go to class. They do what they're supposed to do. They're great to be around. They work hard. We moved leagues. We were having a lot of success in the America East, which is a low major league. And we moved to the CAA, which is one of the best mid-major leagues in college basketball. I mean, we had two Final Four teams out of our league. So last year, College of Charleston won the league. They were ranked 18th in the country. So, I mean, it's hard, man. This league is a total different experience. And, you know, we recruited to the other league and then got guys getting older, playing in a much better league. So, you know, it's going to take us a little time to build it into CAA quality. But I, you know, I'm excited about this year. We got a nice group. If we stay healthy, I think we can have a nice year and kind of get our program on some solid footing as we move forward to the CAA.
Coach, I don't want to sidetrack things too far, but you mentioned a couple things that kind of at least triggered my curiosity. I mean, you were in the MAC, And then you talked about, you know, the league that you were in and Bradley getting four teams in to the tournament. The CAA is what it is. I mean, it's a very, very good league. I've always been interested in the inside perspective of guys that live it. Look, maybe I just don't understand what the difference is between the CAA and the MAC, but I've been a very frustrated person as a basketball fan that the MAC is just pigeonholed as a one-bid league. And I don't, I'd like your take on why it seems that that has to be that way, because it feels to me like the MAC damn sure deserves two teams in most years.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to say something that'll probably be a little unpopular with some, but it's what makes it hard. So the MAC is the best one-bid league in America. The fact that, you know, when you have 1A football and you're a mid-major conference, finances are stretched thin, and you're going to say, well, why does that matter? And I'm going to tell you that you have to be able to buy home games to get right. the computer ratings higher. And if you go through the Mid-American Conference, there are some teams that are really investing and really trying to win. You know, Akron invests, Kent invests, Ohio invests, Toledo invests. And I'm not going to say they're the only four, because there are a few others. I'm not in the league, and I've been out of the league for over a decade, so I, you know, I don't know the inner workings of everybody, but I know those four schools for a fact. But you also have some schools that aren't investing in scheduling. And to buy a home game was going to cost you $75,000 to $80,000. So when you can buy three or four home games, which is what the Missouri Valley was doing when I was in it at Bradley, and that's why they got so many bids. When you can buy, when every school in the league is buying four home games, you go into conference, a team that isn't any good, because home teams are going to win 75 to 80% of the games in college basketball anyway.
Right.
Just what it is. And so when you're able to invest and buy games, now you go into the league and your worst team might be 6-6 non-league. Instead, when you can't buy those games, your worst team goes in the league 2-10. So now when you're the top team in the MAC and you got to play that bottom team that was 2-10 non-league, it crushes your computer ratings. So right. the net gets beat up because you're beating a team that's horrible. And it'd be the same team, but there's a big difference between winning four home games and going on the road and being cannon fodder and buy games that you can't win, or playing home and homes with schools that you're not able to beat. And so I think it's hard, but I mean, that's why the Missouri Valley did it. And the problem is you'll never get to multiple bids. You'll never improve net ratings if everyone in the league isn't going to spend, because it only takes two schools at the bottom to decide not to spend, or three schools at the bottom. And then the whole net rating is crushed. Everybody has to do it. And in the Missouri Valley, Doug Elgin was the commissioner. There were rules in place for scheduling. We had to buy four home games. We were not allowed to be bought on the road. We had to play in an exempt tournament that was on a neutral court or at your own place. You were not allowed to go on the road for two games, like these exempt tournaments where you go on the road, and then play neutral twice, and you get, the school gets paid
right.
100, maybe 20,000 to do that. We weren't allowed to do those things. And all of the ADs and all of the presidents approved the plan, and it worked. So if you don't have everybody on board, and it's hard because you're talking about a ton of money, man, like, but it's got to be everybody. It can't be half the league. So I, you know, the only way the MAC's realistically going to get two bids is they're going to have one team just, you know, be unbelievably dominant and then get beat in the championship. But, you know, it's still hard. I mean, we had a team in our league last year. College of Charleston was 31-3, and they were ranked 18th at one point. I don't know for sure if they were going to get in, and they got really unlucky. And not that you know, you really follow it or care this way out of the region, but they beat North Carolina.
Oh yeah.
In a normal year, that would carry your whole computer rate. Well, last year North Carolina stunk.
They tanked.
How would you ever know?
Yeah.
How would you know? They beat Virginia Tech. They weren't as good as what they have been. they were, you know, they're always a tournament team and good. They had another, I'm drawing a blank, but they had three big time wins that weren't big time wins because the teams didn't turn out to be who they've always been. And how are you ever going to know that?
Right.
You
know? So, no question. Well, listen, in the time that we got left, I just wanted you to talk a little bit about your evolution as a coach through all of the journey that you've described here. And I think it's been a fascinating journey that you've been on. You've arrived at a place that's not anywhere like where you grew up and Stony Brook on Long Island, where you are as a coach, and you can touch on whatever you think is important, but I'd like to, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to hear about your evolution in terms of philosophically where you are. And then I don't really care as much about the X's and O's, but I do want to at least get your thoughts on this. It feels to me like, Gino, that everybody basically plays the same style of basketball today. And if that's the case, if the game's going to be homogenized across the board, regardless of level, regardless of league, it feels like we're headed to a time when the guys with better players win all the games, not just most of them. And that's a concern for me. And so I guess a little bit about your philosophy, how you've evolved in terms of what's your why for doing what you do, and then style of play and X's and O's wise, what's it look like to play Stony Brook basketball the way you want to play?
Well, you know, to your point, coaching's changed. The game's changed. I mean, a lot of the evolution has been really good. Some of it's probably a little more challenging and not all as good. I would hate, you know, would hate to be a dominant back-to-the-basket center today just because it's harder. The guys you're playing with aren't used to playing with you and aren't used to playing with a guy like that. So, you know, it's hard for everybody. But I think that, you know, coaching wise, I've been really lucky. I've never coached anywhere where I went was waking up in the morning wishing I wasn't there. I've really enjoyed it. It's been hard. I've had, you know, plenty of downs. You know, there's whether I've been fired as a head coach, I was fired as an assistant coach as part of that staff. You know, you just got to keep moving forward. And I think if I was to look back, I would tell you that here's the challenge. So when I first started coaching, I only knew one way to do everything, and it was what Coach Hunter had taught us. So if there was a sideline ball screen, we were going to hedge the sideline ball screen. And that was the end of the story. There was no other option. That was what we did. And so when I got to Shawnee State, I coached just like he taught me to coach. And as I've gotten older, now I realize, well, we could ice the ball screen. We could hedge the ball screen. We could trap the ball screen. We could switch it. I mean, we could blue it if the guy's a shooter. We kind of one-step hedge and stay attached. I mean, we've got six different ball screen coverages for a sideline ball screen. And I think what you have to watch is, are we going to be any good at any of them? Because I'd rather be great at one of them than really mediocre or poor at all six of them. And I think that when you have more ways to teach things and more options, it's important to remember that these decisions for our players happen really fast. They don't have a lot of time to think while they're playing. They have to react and anticipate. And the more anticipatory you can be and the less reactionary you can be, generally a much better thing on either end of the floor. So I think when you're coaching, you got to be really conscious of who am I coaching? Because not all the guys learn at the same level and just as fast or learn the same way. And so you think about these things a lot more as you become an older coach, and you probably aren't as good at some of the fundamental small things because you just got more things that you're trying to get done. And I try to fight that internal battle with myself all the time about, you know, let's try to be really good at these two things and instead of giving them six. And it's hard. And I think the other thing is the season length has made coaching hard. Our guys are here. We sent them home for 3 weeks in May. We'll send them home at the end of August for 2 weeks. They'll get 3 days at Christmas. Other than that, they're here with us. I mean, 46 weeks a year, they're hearing our coaches' voices. And that's hard. That's hard. It's a lot of time. I mean, I don't care who you love in your life. You don't want to be with them every day, all day. I mean, maybe you do, but I mean, like, it's, most of us need a little change of scenery.
No, no, I don't, Gino. I don't.
Wife's listening. Be very careful how you respond to that. But you know what I mean? Like, I think that we all need a little variety in our life, and you need to stay sharp. And Jimmy Christian used to call it sharpening the saw. And he was right. And I think that was something that Jeff was so good at, was keeping our guys fresh. I mean, there were a few days we'd come in, we're supposed to be doing practice or something, and I mean, he would just sense that we had no energy, and he would just scrap his entire plan, and we might just do some shooting competitions and hot play music and high five them and get them in the showers, and then the next day they'd come in and they'd be ready to work. That's what I would, you know, I hope that Jeff rubbed off on me. I know he did some. I hope he did a lot, because, you know, I just think there's so many ways to do this thing. And I've been really lucky, just really lucky. I mean, Coach Hunter, I think I took toughness. Jimmy Christian had just great respect for his offense. Jeff, really great respect for his feel and compassion for people. I mean, if I was a college player, I would tell you that you want to play for Jeff Bowles. That's a fact. Nobody that's played for Jeff has had a bad experience with Jeff. He's just an A-plus person and leader, and he treats people great. I don't care if you're the 15th guy. You're going to feel just as important as the first guy. And I try hard to do that. Jeff's so elite at it. I know that I don't do it anywhere close to as good as he did, but I certainly do it better than I used to do it.
Well, I know that your journey is going to continue. I'm looking forward to it. I try to follow every conference at least a little bit to know who the good teams are every year. And when Jeff got to Stony Brook, I obviously paid a little more attention. When you took over, I got a little more locked in to want to know what's going on. And I love that you're honest. I mean, it's hard. And so particularly, you talked about all the things that are making it harder, and you didn't talk about the transfer portal, and you didn't talk about NIL, and you didn't talk about some of the things that are front of mind for most people. But I'll be pulling for the Seahawks for sure, and looking forward to seeing how things develop for you. Now, I used to have a rule in season one of the podcast during the pandemic when nobody had anything to do. I used to just say, hey, if you get a minute, I'll shoot you my address. Can you send me a T-shirt for your program? I haven't asked that of anybody for a long time, but I would love to have a Stony Brook shirt.
No, not a problem. You get me your address. I'd love to send you one, and please feel free to wear it around, Aaron. That'll drive home the point that I have never worn.
I will wear it. In fact, I might take a picture and send it to Aaron with me in it after I get the shirt. So that's a guaranteed promise. You've been more than gracious with your time, and I told you I wanted to try to wrap it up in about an hour and a half max, and we're right up against that. So just let me tell you, thanks for everything. We can talk a little bit after we stop recording, but I do appreciate it, and I maybe touch base as we get a little closer to the year. Good luck to you.
Awesome. Thanks. I've enjoyed it. I appreciate it, and best of luck with the podcast moving forward. Thanks, Sean.
Yep, you bet. Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in and checking this one out. If you're listening on Spotify, courtesy of our platform, Spotify for Podcasters, you have the opportunity to make a donation to the podcast. If you would be inclined to do so, there's a link at the bottom of the episode that will allow you to make your donation in whatever amount you would choose to do so. If you're listening on any other platform, I just ask that you please rate, review, and subscribe, and come back anytime to check out more episodes here on the Basketball and Life Podcast.